the greatest objection than ever of daily life to the market that happens in one urban center of sub-Saharan Africa after another throughout this period. And what we get is the emergence of what commentators have described as a, quote, new witchcraft. This new witchcraft essentially switches from older idioms in which witches devour people to new idioms in which, in fact, what witchcraft does is to seize you and turn you into a zombie laborer. What you get again in sub-Saharan Africa is the relationship between zombie labor on the one hand and fantastic accumulation of wealth on the other. The mysteries of capitalist accumulation are being explained via the metaphor, the imagery of the zombie laborer.
You're listening to episode 634 of Unwelcome Guests, The Coming Apocalypse, etc. I'm Robin Upton, and you've just heard political science professor David McNally exploring parallel between the fact and the fiction of sub-Saharan Africa. Why did ideas about the undead change at that particular time? He's going to be making a more general point that the popular culture allows for people to discuss topics indirectly, which may be too painful for them to directly address. Does that thought allow us to understand better why, as Adam Curtis expresses it at the start of his series, The Power of Nightmares, yesterday's politicians used to promise us a better world, today's politicians threaten us with a worse world? Or why finding a piece of stone somewhere should suggest there's evidence that the world might end in December 21st, 2012? Well, if it does, this is going to be our last show, just missing out by one day on episode 635. So I'll take the opportunity in advance to thank you for your attention and feedback. And what better way to end the series than to look at warnings of doom, catastrophes? Now, we won't be looking at the details of ecological calamities, which strike me as a lot more plausible than unspecified metaphors about social collapse or financial collapse. Nevertheless, if you're a US listener, I dare say you've been bombarded by talk of the fiscal cliff, and the fact that my father, hardly a keen observer of the geopolitical situation, sent me an email to ask what would it mean if Greece went bankrupt, suggests to me there's been a lot of media attention paid in emotive and vague metaphorical terms to matters fiscal, attention which never paid heed to the fundamental truth that whilst ecological matters concern the real world, financial matters are ultimately based on the fictional man-made world. And for some historical perspective, we go back several hundred years. We're going to hear a 10-minute section from Chapter 6 of David Graeber's book on debt about the spectres which haunted the Tiv culture in West Africa at the time of the European-led slave trade exporting Africans to the New World. One gets a distinct sense in much of the literature that many African societies were haunted by the awareness that these elaborate networks of debt could, if things went just slightly wrong, be transformed into something absolutely terrible. The Tiv are a dramatic case in point. Among students of anthropology, the Tiv are mainly famous for the fact that their economic life was divided into what their best-known ethnographers, Paul and Laura Bohannon, referred to as three separate spheres of exchange. Ordinarily, everyday economic activity was mostly the affair of women. They were the ones who filled the markets and who trod the paths, giving and returning minor gifts of okra, nuts or fish. Men concerned themselves with what they considered higher things, the kind of transactions that might be conducted using the Tiv currency, which, as with the lele, consisted of two denominations, a kind of locally made cloth called tugudu, widely exported, and, for major transactions, bundles of imported brass rods. These could be used to acquire certain flashy and luxurious things, cows, purchased foreign wives, but they were mainly for the give-and-take of political affairs, hiring curers, acquiring magic, gaining initiation into cult societies. In political matters, Tiv were even more resolutely egalitarian than the Lele. Successful old men, with their numerous wives, might have lorded it over their sons and dependents within their own house compounds, but beyond that, there was no formal political organization of any sort. Finally, there was the system of wards, which consisted entirely of men's rights in women. Hence the notion of spheres. In principle, these three levels, ordinary consumption goods, masculine prestige goods, and rights in women, were completely separate. No amount of okra could get you a brass rod, just as, in principle, no number of brass rods could give you full rights to a woman. In practice, there were ways to game the system. Say a neighbour was sponsoring a feast, but was short on supplies. One might come to his aid, and then later, discreetly, ask for a bundle or two in repayment. To be able to wheel and deal, to turn chickens into cows, as the saying went, and ultimately, to broker one's wealth and prestige into a way of acquiring wives, required a strong heart, that is, an enterprising and charismatic personality. But strong heart had another meaning too. There was believed to be a certain actual biological substance called salve, which grew on the human heart. That was what gave certain people their charm, their energy, and their powers of persuasion. Salve, therefore, was both a physical substance and that invisible power that allows certain people to bend others to their will. The problem was, and most Tiv of that time appear to have believed that this was the problem with their society, that it was also possible to augment one's tsav through artificial means, and this could only be accomplished by consuming human flesh. Now, I should emphasize right away that there is no reason to believe that any Tiv actually did practice cannibalism. The idea of eating human flesh appears to have disgusted and horrified them as much as it would most Americans. Yet, for centuries, most appear to have been veritably obsessed by the suspicion that some of their neighbors, and particularly prominent men who became de facto political leaders, were in fact secret cannibals. Men who built up their tsav by such means, the story went, attained extraordinary powers, the ability to fly, to become impervious to weapons, and to be able to send out their souls at night to kill their victims in such a way that their victims didn't even know that they were dead, but would wander around, confused and feckless, to be harvested for their cannibal feasts. They became, in short, terrifying witches. The Mbatsav, the Society of Witches, was always looking for new members, and the way to accomplish this was to trick people into eating human flesh. A witch would take a piece of the body of one of his own close relatives, whom he'd murdered, and place it in the victim's food. If the man was foolish enough to eat it, he would contract a flesh debt, and the Society of Witches ensured that flesh debts are always paid. Quote, "Perhaps your friend, or some older man, has noticed that you have a large number of children, or brothers and sisters, and so tricks you into contracting the debt with him. He invites you to eat food in his house, alone with him, and when you begin the meal, he sets before you two dishes of sauce, one of which contains cooked human flesh." Unquote. If you eat from the wrong dish, but you do not have a strong heart, the potential to become a witch, you'll become sick and flee from the house in terror. But if you have that hidden potential, the flesh will begin to work in you. That evening, you will find your house surrounded by screeching cats and owls. Strange noises will fill the air. Your new creditor will appear before you, backed by his confederates in evil. He will tell of how he killed his own brother so that you two could dine together, and pretend to be tortured by the thought of having lost his own kin as you sit there, surrounded by your plump and healthy relatives, The other witches will concur, acting as if all this is your own fault. You have sought for trouble, and trouble has come upon you. Come and lie down on the ground, that we may cut your throat. There's only one way out, and that's to pledge a member of your own family as a substitute. And this is possible because you'll find you have terrible new powers, but they must be used as the other witches demand. One by one, you must kill off your brothers, sisters, children. Their bodies will be stolen from their graves by the College of Witches, brought back to life just long enough to be properly fattened, tortured, killed again, then carved and roasted for yet another feast. Quote, "The flesh debt goes on and on. The creditor keeps on coming. Unless the debtor has men behind him who are very strong in salve, he cannot free himself from the flesh debt until he has given up all his people and his family is finished. Then he goes himself and lies down on the ground to be slaughtered, and so the debt is finally discharged." Unquote. The slave trade. In one sense, it's obvious what's going on here. Men with strong hearts have power and charisma. Using it, they can manipulate debt to turn extra food into treasures, and treasures into wives, wards and daughters, and thus become the heads of ever-growing families. But that very power and charisma that allows them to do this also makes them run the constant danger of sending the whole process jolting back into a kind of horrific implosion, of creating flesh debts whereby one's family is converted back into food. Now, if one is simply trying to imagine the worst thing that could possibly happen to someone, surely being forced to dine on the mutilated corpses of one's own children would, anywhere, be pretty high on the list. Still, anthropologists have come to understand, over the years, that every society is haunted by slightly different nightmares, and that these differences are significant. Horror stories, whether about vampires, ghouls, or flesh-eating zombies, always seem to reflect some aspect of the teller's own social lives, some terrifying potential in the way they're accustomed to interact with each other, that they do not wish to acknowledge or confront, but also cannot help but talk about. In the Tiv case, what would that be? Clearly, Tiv did have a major problem with authority. They lived in a landscape dotted with compounds, each organized around a single older man with his numerous wives, children, and assorted hangers-on. Within each compound, that man had near absolute authority. Outside, there was no formal political structure, and Tiv were fiercely egalitarian. In other words, all men aspired to become the masters of large families, but they were extremely suspicious of any form of mastery. Hardly surprising, then, that Tiv men were so ambivalent about the nature of power that they became convinced that the very qualities that allow a man to rise to legitimate prominence could, if taken just a little bit further, turn him into a monster. In fact, most Tiv seemed to assume that most male elders were witches, and that if a young person died, they were probably being paid off for a flesh debt. But this still doesn't answer the one obvious question. Why is this all being framed in terms of debt?
And now for a more contemporary analysis. Thanks to AgainstTheGrain.org for this recording, and especially the host, C.S. Sung.
What is our long-standing fascination with zombies in fiction and film and other forms of popular culture say about who we are and about the political economic system we navigate every day? Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, examples abound of our preoccupation with the living dead. In 2009, Time magazine declared zombies the official monster of the recession. In a new book entitled Catastrophism, David McNally connects the cultural omnipresence of zombies and other monsters to everyday indignities encountered in capitalist society. The book also examines the contours and perils of catastrophism on the left, on the right, and within the environmental movement. Its authors include Against the Grain's own Sasha Lilly, Eddie Ewan, and James Davis. Catastrophism, according to the book's authors, involves the presumption that society is headed towards some kind of collapse, out of which something positive may or will emerge, a new, better society, or at least the stirring of the masses from a protracted slumber. Later this hour, I'll talk with Sasha about the volume, Catastrophism, and her chapter in it, which describes and evaluates left-wing catastrophism and its consequences. We begin with a talk given by David McNally on the subject of his contribution to the new volume, which is also the subject of his new book, Monsters of the Market, Zombies, Vampires, and Global Capitalism. I want to thank WeAreMany.org for providing the audio. David McNally is a professor of political science at York University in Toronto. He delivered the following remarks at the Socialism 2012 conference, sponsored by the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. Here's David McNally speaking in Chicago on June 28th.
What's interesting is that two monsters made their appearance more or less on the same evening in 1816. Two English authors undertook a horror story competition at a Swiss villa, and one of them was named Mary Shelley. And she went on, as a result of this challenge, to write one of our most famous horror stories of all time, Frankenstein. I'm going to talk a fair bit about Frankenstein in a few minutes. And another person there, John Polidori, wrote the first English language story on the vampire, called The Vampire. So Frankenstein and the vampire are born in the early 19th century. In this 1816 contest, the book Frankenstein appears 2 years later. And while Frankenstein's creature, as I will suggest, morphs later into the zombie, we get here the beginnings of two monster tropes which have stayed with us for nearly 200 years. And when that's the case, I think we need to probe deeply and to ask ourselves what's going on. Why is it that these idioms of horror so dominate within the cultural landscape of capitalism? Because for nearly 200 years, dissection, body snatching, blood sucking, dismemberment have all been cultural themes or cultural tropes around which horror is organized via the popular imaginary. And it all speaks, I'm going to suggest, in part to this profound sense of corporeal or bodily vulnerability that everybody who gets subjected in some way or another to the labor market experiences in capitalist society. Or to put this part of the argument as succinctly as I can, capitalist society produces cultural fears or anxieties about being dissected and about being the living dead. And I think it does so because of profound experiences associated with wage labor. Let me start to unfold that argument by taking a closer look at Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Several things are really interesting about the way Shelley sets out this book that tend not to get very much attention from most commentators. Victor Frankenstein, Shelley tells us early on, engaged in dissection and grave robbing. Now note those two themes, because they become incredibly important. How does he assemble his monster? He dissects animals and he robs human graves. And he assembles his monster by putting together cut up bits of bodies to create this gigantic monstrosity, which then gets jolts of electricity to be brought to life. Shelley has him tell us this. "I became acquainted with the science of anatomy," he explains, "and spent days and nights in vaults and charnel houses." Now, Shelley's readers immediately knew the significance of this. And they knew the significance of it because in one of the houses in which she had grown up, she was around the corner from the most famous prison in London where public hangings took place. And at most public hangings in 18th century London, this, by the way, was utterly unique in terms of European cities, very frequently, after the body of the condemned had been hanged, a pitched battle took place, sometimes lasting for hours, over the body of the victim, over the body of the condemned. Who was it between? It was between the so-called anatomists, the doctors or those who engaged in dissection and anatomy, who wanted more bodies to chop up, and the crowd that gathered there, often unrelated, but sometimes there were relatives of the condemned, who fought them off for hours. Money would change hands as they tried to buy the body, to bribe the crowd into giving it up. This didn't happen in any other European city, these battles. I think it's not an accident that London was at the economic and commercial heart of that country going through the most rapid proletarianization in the world at the time, that is to say, more and more poor people being turned into wage laborers, and in the early stages of industrial capitalism. The riot at the gallows, the riot over the body of the hanged, became a key contestation over the bodies of the poor in London. But note also that Victor Frankenstein engages in grave robbing, not just in dissection. This, too, was a class marker in 18th century London, because given that there was what has been described as a corpse economy throughout London, other British cities, but particularly London, a corpse economy meaning that corpses were getting more and more expensive, and indeed there were price lists for different sizes and sexes of corpses, and indeed price lists for each part of the body that could be bought. So there was a literal corpse economy happening. And as a result, the rich began to have themselves buried in things like iron coffins, padlocked, and so on. The poor were often thrown into paupers' graves. Very easy to dig them up at night. And so-called resurrectionists, or grave robbers, there were crews of them throughout London that would raid the graves of the poor and dig them up and have them sell off the corpses as part of this corpse economy to be cut up. And so we get in this period in London, the period where Mary Shelley starts to compose Frankenstein in the early 19th century, a culture of resistance against the corpse economy, against dissecting the bodies of the poor. Now let's step back and ask ourselves why this is so important, and why Mary Shelley knew this was going to resonate. To set up Victor Frankenstein in this way, she knew, was to set him up as a monstrous character before he constructs his creature. And think for a moment about what it means to sell your labor power in societies where there is no tradition of doing this. And think as well about the fact that we can make almost a trans-historical, trans-cultural generalization that in one society after another, people resist being subjected to wage labor. They will do almost anything they can to cling to a small plot of land and try to reproduce themselves outside the market. Because once you enter the market, several things happen. One, loss of autonomy. You surrender freedom, you surrender autonomy. Secondly, you enter the economy of dead time. You enter the economy where, for 8, or in those days, 10 and 12 hours a day, your life energies, your time does not belong to you. It belongs to somebody else. And if you think of all the expressions that workers use to describe time on the job, and I've used dead time as the most resonant of those, you can see what's going on. Marx puts it this way. The exercise of labor power, labor, is the worker's own life activity. Under capitalism, his life activity is for him only a means to enable him to exist. It is a commodity which he has made over to another. Now, to make over your life activity to someone else as a commodity means to treat it as a thing, to treat it as inanimate, to treat it as dead. This is to part with some of your fundamental humanity, yourself, as a human. As a result, life at work is a form of living death. It is experiencing death, lack of animation, lack of autonomy, lack of control, lack of creativity, lack of human self-expression, and so on, day in and day out, over and over again for a lifetime. And of course, central to it is the idea that your body is seized. And in one way or another, that body is disciplined, regulated, punished, and so on, by the forces of capital, supervisors, foremen, and so on, within the capitalist economy. And so anatomists didn't only symbolize the physical cutting up of the human body, they also symbolized the cutting up of our lives into dead parts and living parts. That metaphor, I'm suggesting, is one of the things that accounts for the great endurance of Frankenstein as a story across now nearly 200 years. Moreover, in seizing a body from the anatomists, in preventing it from being cut up, the crowd was winning a symbolic victory against capital. They were basically saying, there are certain indignities we protest. And if they couldn't resist the labor market entirely, they could at least resist this ultimate indignity of the physical dismemberment. You may be dismembering our lives, you may be cutting up our life experience, but here is one moment where we can win a small victory back, reclaim bodies from the corpse economy. But Mary Shelley doesn't only do that. She also sets out another monstrous trope. And she sets up the rebel monster or the proletarian monster. And I'm going to suggest to you that this is the monster that many of us identify with in zombie films. The moment when the zombies turn the world upside down, trample polite society, scare white, rich, suburban people by marauding through the streets and wreaking havoc and creating a zombie carnival. And what Shelley does is to threaten the ruling class that this is what they're creating. Think, to begin with, even of the imagery of assembling the monster. What is the proletariat? It is people thrown together in the most random way as a result of the cutting up of human lives and throwing them together into these big collectivities in factories, mines, mills, on ships, and so on. Much the same way that Victor Frankenstein grabs body parts and animal parts and throws them all together to create this huge monstrosity. That's what the working class is, particularly from the standpoint of the ruling class. One thing we need to remind ourselves always is how utterly frightened the ruling class is by the specter of plebeian or proletarian insurgents. That is their cultural nightmare, and it's one of the things that gets enacted quite often in zombie films as well. So there is that, but more than that, Mary Shelley's creature has a series of features that the Frankenstein creature loses in Hollywood films. To begin with, he has language. The creature speaks. Boris Karloff, the most famous of the creature actors in Hollywood, insisted that the creature should be deprived of speech, i.e. turned into a zombie. Shelley gives him speech. Moreover, he learns to read. But the capacity for speech, of course, is part of the threat to the ruling class. The monster is not a completely inarticulate, non-rational, unthinking brute. It's capable of communication, it's capable of thought, it's capable of analysis. But as I say, Hollywood zombifies the creature by stripping him of speech and intelligence. As that happens, there becomes an interesting point of intersection with the historical development of the zombie image. The zombie image begins in West Africa, but it has its most profound formation in Haiti. Haiti, of course, was the largest slave colony that France had. It is also the site of the enormous slave revolution that defeats three colonial empires. And the zombie imagery in Haiti becomes particularly resonant during the period of U.S. military occupation after 1915, when U.S. Marines imposed forced labor on large parts of the population. And this idea of being turned into a mindless beast of burden, to be literally stripped of your humanity, of personality, memory, identity, language, and thought, to be turned into nothing but human flesh that labors for others, emerges in Haiti during this period of time. And there's an amazing book written by an American author which becomes hugely influential at the time. His name is William Seabrook, and it's called The Magic Island in 1929. It's full of all kinds of ethnocentric racial stereotypes and so on. But the depiction of zombie labor, particularly in a chapter called Dead Men Walking in the Cane Fields, it was hugely influential in Depression America. That's when the zombie image first starts to make an impact. The book comes out in 1929. What does the Depression bring home other than we're being treated as nothing but mere anatomies capable or not of work? It's this view of the zombie as the mindless laborer which becomes the main cultural trope of the zombie, the main image of the zombie, during the period of the Depression. After that, after the 1940s, the zombie image starts to die out within popular culture, only to undergo a tremendous resonance and renaissance, particularly with the appearance in 1968 of George Romero's Night of the Living Dead. Undoubtedly one of the great classic zombie films, except, I want to spend a moment on this, Romero didn't think his creatures were zombies. He didn't call them zombies. His original name for the film was Night of the Flesh Eaters, and he described them as ghouls. Now, why is that important? Because remember, I'm saying that coming out of Haiti, the zombie is a laborer, stripped of identity, memory, consciousness, and so on. The zombie in the post-1968 period becomes a consumer, not a laborer. A manic, insane flesh eater. Okay? There are lots of critical possibilities with this shift, but something I'm going to argue gets lost with this shift. To depict, for example, a voracious U.S. imperialism at the time of the Vietnam War as a manic, flesh-eating machine does have a lot of critical charge. And there's, look, folks, it's really telling us something that this film is set not in Transylvania, but in Pennsylvania. Okay? You know, it's telling us that America is a scene of horror. Okay? That it is the site of these insane flesh-eating monsters. And interestingly, there is one heroic character in the film, the single black male in the film, and he is the one heroic character. Everybody else is susceptible to idiotic panic. He's the one person capable of actually rationally planning a defense. And, of course, he's ultimately murdered by a kind of posse run by a real kind of redneck white sheriff type. Thank you. So there are lots of critical possibilities with the idea of the zombie, even though, as I said, Romero didn't think of them as zombies, as manic consumers of human flesh. But the danger here is that one of the really critical insights of the original zombie formulation, the mindless laborer, simply being a laboring working machine, gets lost. And I want to suggest to you that a lot of that happens after the New Left goes into decline, as the anti-war movement and Black Power movements recede. It becomes very easy for the zombie metaphor to become a kind of easy cliche in which we just depict our society as choking on its excess of consumption and so on. And I'm not denying that there's some critical possibilities there, but I think it does tend to lose some of the amazing critical charge that exists. You can still see, I think, some of what's possible with it, for example, with Romero's 1978 film Dawn of the Dead, where, I mean, the zombies are drawn manically to a shopping mall. Okay? I mean, that's where they want to be, and they want to get into that shopping mall at all costs. Okay? And so, you know, there is clearly a critique of manic hyper-consumerism as something that drives capitalism. But as I said, the danger of that metaphor is that it loses sight of human labor as what drives the machine, is that it starts to drift into those analyses of late capitalism in which everything revolves around consumption. The shopping mall is the center of capitalism as opposed to the place of work, the site of labor and production. Interestingly, at the same time as that was happening, sub-Saharan Africa became the site for the return of the zombie laborer. And I wanted to spend a minute or two talking about this. This happens beginning in the mid or late 1970s. And interestingly, sub-Saharan Africa becomes that region of the globe most ravaged by structural adjustment programs, neoliberalism, privatization, commodification of fuel, food, housing, water, and so on, electricity, the greater subjection than ever of daily life to the market that happens in one urban center of sub-Saharan Africa after another throughout this period. And what we get is the emergence of what commentators have described as a, quote, new witchcraft. This new witchcraft essentially switches from older idioms in which witches devour people to new idioms in which, in fact, what sorcery does, what witchcraft does, is to seize you and turn you into a zombie laborer. But what you get again in sub-Saharan Africa is the relationship between zombie labor on the one hand and fantastic accumulation of wealth on the other. The mysteries of capitalist accumulation are being explained via the metaphor, the imagery of the zombie laborer. And I want to suggest to you that that always carries a powerful critical charge. That rather than being some weird superstition, this is incredibly insightful. That people are using this zombie labor image to explain how it is that some people in a city like Lagos, which has its walled sections, its gated communities, where the nouveau riche are getting fantastically wealthy, while the majority are living in essentially shanty towns and so on. So I'm not trying to say that that's the whole story, by the way, with any of these images. There are lots of other things that always run through these images. Issues around race, an AIDS pandemic, sexuality, and so on. But I want to emphasize what I think has gotten lost in so much of the discussion, which is these class resonances. Because what you're seeing in this shift from an older to a newer witchcraft in sub-Saharan Africa is from the idea that witches are interested in use value, in consuming you, to the idea that witches are interested in exchange value. Not consuming you, not eating you up, but turning you into a means of production, turning you into a force of labor. Now, What we get today, in other words, if you take both sides of this imagery, is essentially a return to the vampire and the zombie laborer. The vampire is, after all, a consumer of others. The vampire lives off your blood. The ghoul zombie, that is the manic consumer, lives off your flesh and blood. The zombie laborer produces this immense wealth. And so when I said earlier there's a dialectical doubling here, I'm trying to suggest that each of these images projects to us one side of capitalism. Immense accumulation of capital and wealth, the hidden, usually invisible labor that sustains it. The idea of going onto invisible plantations, for example, at night, speaks to something that Marx talks about all the time in Capital. The fact that the source of capitalist wealth is invisible. It's hidden. When we move through the shopping malls, the circuits of commodities, we do not see the labor that brought these commodities into being. And one of Marx's great tasks in Capital is to de-invisibilize or to re-visibilize what it is that drives the immense machinery of capitalism. He tells us that to do this, we need a journey to the hidden abode of production. What the zombie laborer does is to remind us of that hidden abode, that somewhere, however out of sight it might be, labor is happening, and labor is driving this machinery.
And that was David McNally, a political scientist at York University in Toronto, speaking at the Socialism 2012 conference in Chicago on June 28th. I'm C.S. Song. The Socialism conferences are sponsored by the Center for Economic Research and Social Change, the publisher of Haymarket Books and of International Socialist Review. We thank the Center and wearemany.org. for the audio you just heard, which was edited by yours truly.
And there follows an analysis with David McNally's co-author, Sasha Lilly. But first, to lighten up the tone a little, this song entitled Re Your Brains by Jonathan Coulter.
Hey, Tom, it's Bob from the office down the hall. It's good to see you, buddy. How have you been? Things have been okay. Except that I'm a zombie now. I really wish you'd let us in. I think I speak for all of us when I say I understand why you folks might hesitate to submit to our demand. But here's an FYI, you're all gonna die screaming. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes. All we wanna do is eat your brains. We're at an impasse here. Maybe we should compromise. If you open up the door, we'll all come inside and eat your brains. I don't wanna nitpick, Tom, but is this really your plan? Spend your whole life locked inside a mall. Maybe that's okay for now, but someday you'll be out of food and guns, and you'll have to make the call. I'm not surprised to see you haven't thought it through enough. You never had the head for all that bigger picture stuff. But Tom, that's what I do, and I plan on eating you slowly.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're not unreasonable. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're at an impasse here. Compromise. If you open up the door, we'll all come inside and eat your brains. I'd like to help you, Tom, in any way I can.
David McNally was speaking on a topic that is the focus of his contribution to his chapter in a new book entitled Catastrophism, The Apocalyptic Politics of Collapse and Rebirth. The volume's other authors are Against the Grain's own Sasha Lilly, Eddie Ewan, and James Davis. And the book includes a foreword by Doug Henwood. Sasha Lilly joins me now in studio. Hey there, Sasha.
It's good to be with you, CS.
So, how does McNally's essay fit within the rest of this volume, Catastrophism?
Well, in essence, David McNally's piece is almost a coda to the book. The book looks at what we call catastrophism on the left, right, and in the environmental movement. And that is the notion that society is heading for some kind of collapse, whether economic, social, spiritual, ecological, and many catastrophists believe that out of that collapse, a new society will be born. Now, just to be very clear, we're not suggesting in any way that capitalism is not itself catastrophic and that there is not a catastrophic environmental crisis. That is very much the case. But what the book does is it tries to take apart the rhetorics and politics around catastrophe and to look at whether it is a useful way of understanding the world around us and if it leads to better politics or, as we argue, a kind of disabling politics which tends towards pacifying people, immobilizing them. Because what we suggest that links all of these different kinds of politics of catastrophe is that they are bound together by fear, that fear is sort of the operating element in all of them, and a hope by people who deploy catastrophic rhetorics that people will be scared into action. And what we suggest is that while that actually does tend to work for the right, it does not work for the left, and it does not work for the environmental movement, and we should be very wary of it.
So in your chapter in this book, Catastrophism, you discuss two forms, two versions of catastrophism on the left. We will talk about each in some detail, but I'm wondering if you could first briefly lay out the essential thrust, the essential message of each version.
Sure. The left has a long history of catastrophic politics, and it tends to take two forms, but they're not absolute, and often people who veer towards one side find themselves veering towards the other as well. So on the one hand, there is a what I call kind of a determinist catastrophism, and that is based around the notion that capitalism will collapse under its own weight. The other, which I term voluntarist catastrophism, is based on the notion that the worse things get, the better they'll be for radical prospects. So one is more mechanical and one is based more on human activity, but in fact, they have at their core something very similar. although we saw the resurgence of that kind of determinist catastrophism in 2008 at the start of the global financial crisis, where people said, this is it. The system has hit a wall. It's coming down. Capitalism, which has been haunting us all this time and which we've been able to do very little about, is about to crash and burn. And this is our moment. But generally, I would say that that type of catastrophism is less common now. There's certainly a long history of it. And I should be very clear, too, that catastrophism permeates all tendencies within the left, the radical left, certainly the anarchist tradition, the Marxist tradition. If you look at basically any tendency, it's there. But that determinist catastrophism, that expectation that capitalism will collapse under its own weight, I think has receded in many ways because people just generally are less optimistic about capitalism ever coming to an end, which I should say as an aside, I think is unfortunate because capitalism is historically quite a new system and there's nothing eternal about it. But I do believe that it's misguided to think that capitalism itself will just come down under its own weight.
You write that Karl Marx is often remembered as a prophet of capitalism's demise, brought down by the iron laws of history. On what basis is Marx so remembered, and is it fair to attribute such a view to him?
Well, it's understandable to some degree in that in his early writings, especially around the 1848 crisis, which was essentially one of the first crises, global crises of capitalism, he and his collaborator Engels thought, this is the moment, here's a crisis, things are going to collapse. But they didn't collapse then, as we all know. And Marx came to terms with this and recognized that while crises are endemic to capitalism, crises are not the same thing as a collapse of the system. That, in fact, and this is something that I think catastrophists tend to miss, that crises are actually essential for the renewal of the capitalist system, that rather than marking out a sort of endpoint beyond which the system can't progress any further, crises actually serve to help restructure, remake the system and bring in new vital energy. We've certainly seen that during the 2008 crisis, that it has been actually a tremendous opportunity for the capitalist class, even though, of course, some capitalists have fallen by the wayside in the process. So I would say that it is unfortunate that Marx tends to be remembered this way, because really, I think what distinguishes the Marxist view of social change actually has to do with the centrality of human struggle. But that in some ways has carried over, more that there are these laws of history, they can't be messed with in some ways, they're going to just unfold and we can sit on the sidelines and watch that happen. That's not at all the essence of what Marxism and Marxist time was about.
Can you cite maybe one or two radical thinkers in or roughly in the Marxist tradition who pushed back against this notion that capitalism would collapse under the weight of its own contradictions?
Within the spectrum of Marxism, I would say that, to sort of situate it more historically, after the death of Marx and Engels in the teens, the German Social Democratic Party was, in a sense, the place where much of the theoretical and political work of Marxism was generated. This is in the Second International. And there was a whole big debate, which I won't go into, about whether there an evolutionary road to socialism was possible. And there were a number of people who then argued this collapse scenario, which we're talking about, including people who actually have great admiration for, like Rosa Luxemburg. But I think there were some critics who were not arguing for that evolutionary road, who were very clearly located on the radical left, who saw the problems with seeing capitalism that way. And I guess the person I would most point to would be the council communist Anton Panikuk, who said that rather than expecting capitalism to hit these limits, essentially focusing on capitalism's weakness, it really behooved the radical left to actually focus on capitalism's strengths. Rather than imagining that the system was always frail, always tottering, we should realize the ways that the system, in its strength, has pulled people together, has in some ways allowed for that kind of mass class struggle, collective struggle, that in essence is necessary to bring the system down.
Sasha Lilly is author with David McNally, Eddie Ewan, and James Davis of a new book. It's called Catastrophism, The Apocalyptic Politics of Collapse and Rebirth. It's published by PM Press. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. So the assumption that lies beneath this, at least this version of left catastrophism, is that the masses, right, ordinary folks, won't oppose capitalism, won't resist capitalism, unless it is somehow convinced that the system is dying, or it's dead, or it's moribund, or it's stagnant. What do you think, first of all, is that assumption what's really kind of behind some of this? And secondly, what do you think of that, and whether it's historically justified?
Yes, I think that's a fair summary of it. I don't think any of these thinkers or leaders ever articulated it that way. I think they thought they had the force of history and the masses behind them in some sort of abstract sense. But I do think there is a real current of expecting that people will not act unless they think that the system is moribund. And I think that is really problematic, because what characterizes capitalism is its ability to renew itself over and over again. So if you're constantly betting that each crisis is going to lead to collapse, and of course it doesn't, it's obviously not a great track record, but also it really lends itself to the wrong kind of politics. I think what's really important for us to articulate, looking back through this whole history of catastrophism on the left, is the need to oppose capitalism when it's, quote, working, as well as when it seems to be in crisis, because also in crisis, it is actually working. If we don't take that into account, it's not going to resonate with people, because we're kind of waiting for something which will not take shape in the form that we're hoping.
And I do want to ask you at some point about historical tendencies and when, for example, working class upheavals have taken place in relation to capitalism either doing well or not doing so well. But let's move first to the second version of left-wing catastrophism, that the worse, the better, that as conditions worsen, that actually improves prospects for radicals and revolutionaries. How implicated is Marxism in this version of catastrophism?
Well, you can certainly find that sentiment in the Communist Manifesto, that the working class will be pushed to a point of immiseration and will snap and rebel. Although there's actually even in the manifesto more to it than that. There is a whole emphasis also on people being joined together, pulled together in workplaces where they have some collective power. But that isn't the only thread that one sees in the original writings of Marx and Engels about this question. In Wage, Labor, and Capital, Marx argued that rising expectations can lead to rebellion, that seeing yourself do better because you've struggled and won, but seeing others, like your boss, doing even better, can set off rebellion. So it's a complicated question. I don't think there's one simple answer. I would say, if it does matter, and one could argue maybe it doesn't even matter, that the thrust of Marx's writings was to the latter, to the degree to which it really emphasized collective strength, collective power.